You're tuned to WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. It's 6 o'clock. Good evening. Stay tuned up next for a special edition of Sound Ideas. It's a live broadcast from the Normal Theater, a candidate forum for the five people seeking the Democratic nomination to run for Congress in the 13th District. 1 to 3 inches of snow likely tonight. We'll have a low of 13 degrees, partly sunny tomorrow, a high of 22, 28 for a high on Thursday, with cloudy skies.
Support for GLT comes from Legacy Memory Care from Heritage Health. Legacy provides memory support for seniors and peace of mind for family members. Details at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's a special edition of Sound Ideas, bringing you a candidate forum in the Democratic primary race for Congress in the 13th District. Good evening, I'm Charlie Schlenker. The primary election is 6 weeks away. Early voting starts this week on February 8th for some parts of the district, and somewhat later for McLean County because of a pending court case that we're not going to go into right now. Joining us at the Normal Theater are the candidates in alphabetical order: Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, and Angel Sides. Welcome all. Also joining us for this live broadcast is our audience. Thanks to everyone for attending this forum. The forum will feature questions developed by GLT News with input from those submitted at WGLT.org. There will also be time for opening and closing statements. This forum is co-sponsored by the McLean County League of Women Voters, Illinois State University College Democrats, the Normal Theater, and the Illinois State University School of Communication. The League's Becky Gropp and Reagan Rinciosu are serving as our timekeepers. We determined the order by drawing numbers with the lowest number going first, and after that, rotating among candidates alphabetically. We will ask as many questions as time permits during this forum. As moderator, I will call on candidates to make clarifying comments and pose follow-up questions as needed. That brings us to our opening statement, and the first candidate up is Jonathan Ebel.
Good evening. Thank you. You're going to hear a lot of talk in political campaigns, and I guess the central question that you should be asking yourself is, will a candidate back her or his words with action? I don't just talk about national service. I have worn the uniform of the United States Navy. I don't just talk about the value of higher education. I live it every day in my job at the University of Illinois. And I don't just talk about equality. I have actually officiated a same-sex marriage. So what you know about me, whether you agree with my politics or not, is that I have the courage of my convictions, which Rodney Davis clearly lacks. And that's what you should expect from someone whose only qualification really is his connections, who has only ever worked for politicians, and who is hardwired to not think creatively. Privilege me with this job, and your voices will sound in my ears, not those of political elites or corporate PACs. Privilege me with this job, and I will work every day to make you proud of your representative. Thank you.
David Gill.
I'm Dr. David Gill, and I'm a bold progressive Democrat. And my progressive message, single-payer health care now, a $15 an hour minimum wage now, and tuition-free access to public higher education and trade schools now, would improve the lives of virtually everybody that lives here in Illinois 13. And that message, it's not just a good message, that's a winning message. That message won in this district by 7 points back in 2012 when I last ran. And the voters had the misfortune that year of having a liberal independent on the ballot who split the vote just enough to allow Rodney Davis to defeat me by 0.3 percentage point. And I've watched since then as subsequent more conservative Democrats have been destroyed by Rodney Davis by 18 to 20 points. And I can't watch any longer. With this guy we have in the White House, we must have a Democratic majority in the House coming out of the midterms this year, and the surest way to have Illinois 13 be a part of that Democratic majority is to nominate me 6 weeks from today. Thank you.
Your turn for the opener, Eric Jones.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eric Jones, and I live in Edwardsville with my wife and two young sons. And my wife and I decided to take on this challenge and to jump into this campaign because our two young sons, when they're old enough to understand what we're facing in our country right now, we want to be able to tell them that their mom and dad did everything they possibly could to change the direction of this country. And I've been in these fights before, and I've dedicated most of my life to taking on challenges for everyday people. I'm a former Illinois Assistant Attorney General, and I'm also a former congressional investigator. And in those roles, I took on special interests that were hurting people. I took on a government that wasn't listening. And on occasion after occasion, we won those fights. And I'll tell you, I took those fights on and I dedicated my career to this because I'm just a guy from a small town. My dad's a small business owner. My mom's a school teacher. And I've been taking on fights for people throughout my life. And that's what I'm going to go do as a member of Congress for you. I want to go take on these tough challenges and take the fight to Washington. Thank you so much.
You also have 1 minute. Angel Sides.
Yes, my name is Angel Sides. I'm a teacher and an activist, and I've been producing a political commentary on Free Speech TV for the last 10 years. I feel independent media is important because we have a corporate censored media that bamboozles the public into voting against their own best interest, and that is a complete subversion of our political system by major contributors. An oligarchy is what Jimmy Carter calls it. And anyway, I think we need to also get big money out of our elections. Pharmaceutical company contributes money. We have higher drug prices. The oil industry contributes money. We have global warming and pollution. An insurance company contributes money. We have higher premiums and votes against expanding Medicare, single-payer universal health care. So the Republican Party is the biggest corporate party, but if we're not in denial, we also need to transform the Democratic Party and get the big money out of the DCCC.
And our final one-minute opening statement comes from Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Thank you. Thank you for having us tonight. My name is Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, and I am born and raised in Springfield, Illinois, and I've also raised my own family there. And I decided to get into this race the day that I saw our current Congressman Rodney Davis celebrating with Donald Trump and all his cronies on the White House lawn, the day that they decided to rip health care away from millions of Americans. My husband and I have raised three kids, and in 2009 we almost lost our oldest son, Jack. I know what it feels like to be terrified in the hospital, and I know what it feels like to be terrified when you're at home all over again by the bills when they start pouring in. I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. I am in this race to defend our health care, to stand up for our middle class, and to fight back against Donald Trump, Rodney Davis, and this disastrous agenda.
You're listening to a special Sound Ideas and a Democratic Primary Congressional Candidate Forum live from the Normal Theater in Uptown. Ideas for questions for tonight's forum were submitted at WGLT.org. As agreed, each candidate will have up to 90 seconds to answer questions. If in the event of a follow-up question from me, you'll get 30 seconds for that. Carla Bailey Smith of Bloomington wants to know, what makes you the candidate best suited to win against Rodney Davis? And we will start with David Gill.
Well, as I indicated in my opening, I ran for this seat once before against Rodney Davis back in 2012. And my message of single-payer health care and a $15 an hour minimum wage and tuition-free access to higher education won in this district by 7 points. This is a wonderful district. By 7 points, the voters in this district voted for a candidate who supports a woman's right to choose. By 7 points, they voted for a candidate who supports single-payer, who supports aggressive action against climate change, who supports campaign finance reform and the public financing of campaigns. By 7 points, they voted for a candidate who supports marriage equality. And they just had the misfortune that year of having a liberal independent on the ballot. In years that end in a two, the one election after redistricting, then an independent can relatively easily get on the ballot. And in 2018, Rodney Davis won't have the protection of some liberal independent, and I think that I've demonstrated that I can defeat him handily. And I think that those are issues that I emphasize that speak to the voters in this district. whether they consider themselves Republican or Democrat, you have to have the ability to move tens of thousands of swing voters in this district. And whether it's my background working as a physician in emergency departments up and down the district, I've spent time in 5 of the 14 counties here. For one reason or another, voters have come to understand that I'm a man of integrity and that I do this because I care passionately about their well-being. There's no ulterior motive for me. And so that's why I think that I would be the best nominee.
Mr. Jones, why are you the best candidate to beat Mr. Davis?
So what I'm bringing to this race is a track record of fighting on behalf of people and taking on special interests. And when I talk about what I'm going to do, I'm also talking about what I've done. And what I want to do in this race is put my record up against Rodney Davis's. And on issue after issue after issue, I've been on the side of the people of this district, and Rodney's been on the side of special interests. Whether it was when I was in the Illinois Attorney General's office, I took on student loan servicing companies that were forcing young people to pay more in their student loans than they should be. What did Rodney Davis do? Nothing when the Department of Education rolled back all those protections that we put in place. I also fought on behalf of Illinois workers to take away these things called payroll cards, which were charging people fees just to take off money, just to access their paycheck. What's Rodney Davis done? Sided with the big banks and allowing the Trump administration to dismantle all the protections that were put in place following the financial crisis. Or whether it's on climate change, I took on the Bush administration for politicization of science and uncovered that they were, you know, executives in the White House, oil and gas executives were editing science reports, taking out the word climate change and putting in something else. What's Rodney Davis done on those issues? Absolutely nothing. I've been on the side of fighting for net neutrality. Rodney Davis has voted to take away net neutrality. I've also been on the side of fighting for people against health insurance companies that were spending too much money on CEO pay and not enough money on health care for people. And what's Rodney done? He tried to take away our health care. And so on issue after issue after issue, I'm going to be able to go up against Rodney with my track record and show that my interests have been there forever for Rodney. And I'll say one last thing. Rodney has talked about how he grew up working at McDonald's. Well, I can say, everybody, I worked at Dairy Queen.
Besides, why does the surest path to victory over Congressman Davis go through you?
Well, I think the first thing voters should look for when they vote for someone is, how is that politician funded? I haven't taken any corporate money or any money from super PACs. I think the second thing is, how long has that politician been saying what they're saying? I've been an activist for the better part of my life. So I'm not exactly pandering to the vote. I have actually held a protest in front of Rodney Davis's office having to do with the TPP. I've been arrested during Democracy Springs alongside Code Pink, the Young Turks. I've Wolfpack was arrested the day I was there. I've been traveling all over the country protesting all these pipelines being put in. I have marched and protest and spoke against the pipelines and fracking here in Illinois. So I'm not exactly pandering to the vote, but I think that's two things people should look for whenever they vote for any candidate for any race. I campaigned for Bernie Sanders, and based on the fact that he was taking small donations, and he has been saying the same thing for a very long time. And I think if everyone would follow the money when they vote, that he would be the president right now. He'd be in much better shape.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up. Why are you the best chance to take the seat from a Republican?
I am deeply rooted right here in the 13th District. I have, not only have I been born and raised here and raised my own family here, I've gone to school here. My roots are right here. And people will trust that when I go to Washington, D.C., I am going there to represent you. It's what I have always done. Whether it's been through advocating for children's hospitals or the group I co-founded called Women Rising, which recruits, supports, and elects progressive women to local office. I don't just talk the talk, I walk the walk, and I do it right here in the 13th District. And when it comes to health care, there is not another candidate who will take that fight to Rodney Davis and hold him accountable like a mother who would have lost her son, who would have lost her home, who would have lost her livelihood. If it wasn't for the protections that we have in place, I will fight back on health care. I will fight back on the taxes that he wants to impose. Just like I stood next to the grad students here at ISU and Wesleyan when Rodney supported the bill that granted, that took away the tuition waivers from graduate students. This is where I stand. This district is where I'm planted. It's where my home and my heart are. And in 2018, this is a great year to have a woman on the ballot in Congress. So ladies, we got to pull it together and make sure that we take one more step toward equality in Congress.
And Mr. Ebel, you bet cleanup on this one.
Thank you. I think that you should vote for me because I am the only ballet dancing marathon running religion professor veteran in this race. Now that matters. Each of those things matter. I dance ballet not because I am the next Baryshnikov. I do it because it allows me to spend time with my children. As I said earlier, I live my values. All three of my daughters are deeply involved in ballet. I realized early on that if I was going to spend quality time with them, I needed to put on the shoes. I'm a marathon runner. What does that tell you about me? It tells you that I am determined, that I am disciplined, and that I have a tolerance for pain. Politics is not a pain-free exercise, and being able to take it is a good thing. I'm a religion professor. Now, look around the world, whether it's in our domestic sphere or globally, and tell me, look me in the eye and tell me that religion does not matter in domestic policy or in foreign policy. I think we need more people who have that kind of training in our government, not less. I'm also a veteran. I'm the one person on this stage who knows what foreign policy feels like, who has had to pick up a phone and have my commanding officer on the other end saying, John, your name is on the mobilization list. And then having to turn to my wife, who was 6 months pregnant, and my two-year-old daughter, and tell them that Daddy was going away and we weren't quite sure when he was coming back again. That experience, as well as the lived bipartisanship of military service, is, I think, a great foundation for running in the 13th District.
Thank you all for that, those answers. As you might expect, some of the questions overlap. There are several on what is perhaps one of the most defining issues for Democrats in the last nine to 20 years, health care. Christopher Myers of Bloomington asks a simple yes or no, oh, if it were only so simple. Do you believe that all Americans have a right to health care? And Mr. Jones, we'll start with you this time.
Well, that's a good question, and I have a simple answer to that, which the answer is yes. And the question then becomes, how do we achieve that? So I've been saying throughout this campaign that I believe that health care is a human right, and that we need to be achieving universal coverage in this country as soon as possible. And I'm not new to this fight. I will tell you in my background, when I was a congressional investigator, I took on health insurance companies during the fight for the ACA. And we uncovered that insurance companies were spending up to 40% of the premium dollars that they'd received from their policyholders on things unrelated to healthcare. They were spending on CEO pay. They were spending on advertising and marketing. And so we took them to task on that. We put out a report, and we made some progress on it. So now insurance companies have to spend more on patient care instead of on these other things. But the problem is that's not enough. The steps that we took on the ACA were half steps, and we have to go the whole way. And to do that, we have to, and this is what I've been proposing, we have to open up the Medicare system so that anybody in this country has access to health care. And we can do it allowing people to either opt in or to buy into Medicare so that everyone has it and it's affordable. I'll tell you, I've gone throughout this district. I've heard too many stories of too many families being affected by healthcare catastrophes that happened to them. We can't stop emergencies from occurring to us. We cannot stop from getting sick, but we can make sure that there's not a catastrophe on the back end once you're trying to recover or you're trying to get the services you need. And healthcare is too expensive in this country. We need to take on the pharmaceutical companies, and we need to take on the healthcare companies so we have the government involved. Thank you.
Ms. Sides, you're up. Right or privilege for healthcare?
I think it's a right. I would support H.R. 676. It's already a bill out there that, as I campaign, I'm asking people to call their congressmen to co-sponsor and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 676. But it covers everyone, guaranteed coverage. Would save the average family of four $4,000 a month when you consider the high cost of insurance premiums. And I think that it also covers, well, a lot of people say, well, this is socialism, and I just want to point out we already have socialism in this country, like the libraries, our fire departments, our schools, and our Social Security. So I think first and foremost, if anything is socialized, it should be our health care. And so it covers drug rehabilitation and home care for the elderly. And it is something that I'm passionate about. I held a town hall to have a referendum to put it on the ballot to be passed just for the state of Illinois. But I just feel that people don't need to be stressed out when they're sick. And the elderly need a simple solution for health care. When you're stressed out, it actually affects your health. And so, first and foremost, people don't need to worry about
time
medical
on that
bills
one.
When they're sick.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up.
That's a resounding yes. I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. And right now, what we can do is we can achieve universal health care coverage. The first step to doing that is by stabilizing the ACA and making sure that we stop the bleeding that's happening right now. The Republicans are doing everything they can to chip away at health care because they couldn't repeal it, because people stood up and said no. We have to continue to do that, and we have to have people in the room at the decision-making tables who are going to try to stabilize it and then move forward. When we move forward, we can incorporate a public option. There are great plans out there right now, whether it's a Medicare X or Medicaid for All. There's great plans out there. We have to have the right people at the decision-making tables. We can right now unshackle Medicare to bargain for prescription drug prices. These are things that we can do now to make sure that we have quality, affordable health care accessible to everyone. The number one impediment right now to our health care is congressmen like Rodney Davis.
And Mr. Ebel.
I do believe that health care is a universal human right, and I support expanded, improved Medicare for All. I come to this position from a moral perspective and through a series of questions that I ask myself, which is, what is the right number of babies that can't see a doctor? What's the right number of families bankrupted by a chronic illness? What's the right number of hospitals that go under because they're not being paid for the services they provide? For me, that number is zero. And if you want to hold on to the ACA and perform a little bit of triage, your number is significantly higher than zero. In fact, it's in 30 million or so. This was a good step in the right direction. It was a good idea to try to expand healthcare, but it hasn't gone nearly far enough. And those people who are outside of that umbrella are waiting, and they are at risk at any moment of losing their everything they've earned, losing their livelihood because of an illness. This is something that is part of who we are as people. We are all going to be sick at some point. We are all going to need a doctor. There is no reason why we can't institute on a nationwide basis a system that covers everyone, that makes it so that everyone needs who needs care can get that care. To me, that is a moral calling for all of us, and it's the moral issue of our time.
And Dr. Gill.
I know a lot about healthcare. I've been a doctor for 30 years. For 25 years, I've been a member of a group called Physicians for a National Health Program. Oh, and the answer to your question, Christopher, is yes. Immediately, healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. I joined PNHP 25 years ago. They are the group of 20,000 doctors that have been pushing for single-payer healthcare in this country for decades. They wrote H.R. 676, the single-payer bill that currently is in the House. I spent time as the assistant director of the Illinois Department of Public Health back at a pivotal time when we were developing and implementing the rollout of the ACA here in Illinois. And we need single-payer healthcare now, not tomorrow. Because every day that goes by that we leave the for-profit private health insurance industry running the show is another day that an American citizen dies every 15 minutes just because they don't have the right kind of insurance. 100 Americans dead every day for that reason. And on the flip side, we've got a system run by the for-profit private health insurance industry with individuals like William McGuire. He was the CEO of United Healthcare, retired a few years ago, and was given a retirement bonus of $1.6 billion with a B, dollars. So do the arithmetic. William McGuire gets $100,000 a day, every day to spend on himself for 42 years, 100 grand a day, and on each of those days, 100 Americans die because they don't have the right kind of insurance. We can do so much better, and we will.
Thank you, soon. Dr. Gill. You're all crystal clarion clear about that last question. Regardless of your beliefs, though, it is also clear that our country currently has no shared vision for health care. Even the Affordable Care Act was a bridge too far for many Americans. Do you believe that such a unified policy or vision is an important predicate to addressing health system deficiencies? And if so, Larissa Armstrong of Bloomington and Lori Walrab of Normal both want to know how you would go about developing one. And let's start with Angel Sides.
Well, I mean, I think we do have the funds to go to a single-payer system.
Let me redirect you. That was a political question. How do you develop a shared vision among everyone?
Well, I think a lot of people consider it socialized medicine. It would take a lot of education. A lot of people think we can't afford it, and we can. And I would just share, you know, that information because, you know, when we subsidize industry so highly and we a lot of our tax dollars go to war and things like bailing out the banks. If we can do all that, we're the richest country in the world. We can afford health care. Every industrialized country in the world has some form of universal health care, except the United States. So you have to ask yourself, how are we different than them when we're the richest country in the world and we don't have it? So, I mean, it would take a lot of education and just bombarding people with the facts that, you know, it would help our economy and we need to end these perpetual wars where 64% of our discretionary spending goes to war. And I think, you know, just educating the public like that. Because, you know, as I'm doing a commentary on independent media and how corrupted our media is, and we really do have corporate censored media, and people don't realize it, and that's the kind of thing that gives people that attitude with the rhetoric and
thank
propaganda.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so it takes some education.
Ms. Dirksen, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, is a shared vision on healthcare policy necessary, and if so, how do we get there?
It is. One of my favorite ladies, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has a quote that I love. Fight for the things that you believe in, but lead so others will want to follow you. And I think with the health care, with moving our health care forward, in order to create a unified vision, we have to meet people where they're at right now. Right now, we have a lot of people who do benefit from the ACA. We have a lot of people who like their employer-provided health insurance. We have a lot of labor unions who have made huge investments to make sure that their members have fantastic health care. We have senior citizens who love Medicare. We have all of these plans out there right now. So let's introduce another option to cover people who don't fall into those categories. That's why I believe that universal health care coverage is the first step. Let's get everybody covered and get access to quality, affordable health care for everyone. And let's work together on creating that unified vision of how we continue to move forward.
Jonathan Ebel.
I'm not sure. If we need a shared vision to implement any policy in the United States, we're really not going to get much done. I am a historian of the United States, and I know that from the very beginning, whether it's the colonial period or anywhere forward, there's always been division. And what we have lost, it seems to me, is a desire or an ability to reach some sort of compromise. So a couple of things. I believe that we could do a better job as progressive Democrats arguing for the financial benefits of Medicare for All. People oftentimes point to the expense without acknowledging that we are already in a very expensive and inefficient system, and that by most measures, Medicare for All would reduce those costs and deliver a better product. And I think that Americans are always open to that line of argument. I think, too, and one of the reasons that I approach this from a moral perspective is that we as a people respond positively to calls for to help our fellow Americans, to acknowledge how knit together we are as a people. So that would be another way in which we can work toward that shared vision. It is not going to be easy, but I think it is morally urgent for us to acknowledge those who are outside of the current healthcare system, who are not being cared for, and to find a way to bring everyone in under that umbrella.
David Gill, shared visions and ways to get there.
I agree with John. I don't think a shared vision is entirely necessary. You're not going to have 100% of the American public on board with an improved Medicare for All or single-payer healthcare system. William McGuire, the retired CEO of UnitedHealthcare, he's not going to like the type of program that I'm talking about. But to a certain extent, a shared vision is necessary. And to a large extent, it's already present among the voting public. As a member of PNHP, I've been following this for a quarter century. When I started there, 20% of the public wanted single payer. Now 60% does. 60% of doctors want a single payer healthcare system in this country. Who doesn't want it are the William McGuires and the members of Congress who take all those large checks from the pharmaceutical industry and the health insurance industry. People want it. People are demanding it. They need to elect different people. And I think that they have an opportunity here in Illinois 13 to elect not just a congressperson, but a game changer. Because we've been talking about single payer for decades. FDR put it in his second Bill of Rights that unfortunately didn't get passed. Republican Richard Nixon was talking about single payer in 1970. But decade after decade goes by, and we keep having an American die every 15 minutes because we don't get this passed. Send a doctor to Washington who can tell the horror stories, who has lived the horror stories, and who can address the myths that are out there. And I think that I can take the position of a leader in moving this country toward the single-payer healthcare system that is desperately needed.
Eric Jones, your take on the question.
Thank you. So I've been involved in these processes before, trying to create compromise or create bills to get enough consensus together so you can get a bill through either the legislature in Springfield or Washington. I've done that over and over again. And I will tell you, at some point, you do need a consensus to get something through. And we will have to fight for that. Now, is that going to mean everyone is going to be together on something? Absolutely not. But the way we're going to do this, one is, I actually believe that if you talk to anybody in this country, everyone agrees that we have problems with our healthcare system right now. Whether it's because somebody doesn't have access to it at all, or it's because they're a small business owner and their premiums are costing them $25,000 a year. I've talked to a lot of people in this situation. And while Obamacare or ACA made steps in the right direction, one thing that did not get done, and this was because of an effort by special interests and the insurance companies, was anything to do on cost control. And I do believe that there is an interest in cost control and expansion of access in this country, and I think there is a consensus to get this done. But we have to get the right people in Washington who are willing to fight for it and who understand how to build a record. And what we're going to have to do is get to Congress and put together hearings and do investigations to show what people are paying and how much is coming out of their pocket and show them what we can do to fix that. And there are plenty of options out there to do that. And I actually believe that when we get a new president and we get a new Congress, we will get this done. There is a lot of agreement among both Republicans and Democrats on going after the pharmaceutical companies to ensure that our pharmaceutical prices go down. We need to allow Medicare and the government to be negotiating there, and there are options there I think we can achieve.
Thank you all. I'm going to ask a follow-up question. Everyone's going to get 30 seconds, and we're going to go in the same order. So Angel Sides will start, and the question deals with the point that Eric Jones just raised about cost control. What steps would you take to address the fragmentation in healthcare, to promote continuity and coordination of care and access to the continuum of quality care that drives that drives cost control, prevention, mental and oral health services, all that coordination can drive cost control. How would you get to a lower overall cost?
Yeah, HR 676 actually phases out the insurance companies while it retrains the workers. So I think, you know, a lot of what is being said about it is nurses take over a larger role. So I think we have the money, it's just where our taxes are being diverted. They're not being diverted back to the American people. You know, like, we have to end the big tax breaks for the rich, end the tax loopholes, and end all these perpetual wars that we are constantly
Thank you very
fighting.
Much. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan?
Well, in addition to bringing down the pharmaceutical costs, right now Medicare has instituted programs called shared savings programs. And it really encourages a different set of practices that promotes value over volume. And they have 4 years of data, they're seeing great results in bringing down the costs of service and increasing the care that people are receiving. If we can expand on some of the successes that Medicare has right now, then we can bring costs down, especially if Medicaid adopts it.
Jonathan Ebel.
Two things that I would try to do. First of all, we need to engage in a nationwide education program that transitions us from what we have now, a sick care system, into a health care system, so that people are being trained into wellness from a very early age with exercise and diet, and lowering the bar of access to seeing a physician. That's thing number two. Right now, our healthcare industry and health insurance companies are making their money by de-incentivizing people from seeing doctors, which de-incentivizes early intervention, which raises costs over the long term.
David Gill.
Cost control is easy when it comes to single payer because you'll finally have a system in place. The biggest part of the problem currently, Charlie, is that we don't have a healthcare system. We have this crazy amalgam of 1,500 different insurance companies, millions of different healthcare providers. And when you have a system in place, you can design that system to be as efficient and as good as you want it to be. You can engage in cost controls if necessary. I don't know that they'll be especially necessary. It's today that we throw $1 trillion away for nothing to the for-profit private health insurance industry and waste so much money not negotiating on drug
and
prices.
Eric Jones, you're the last bite at this particular apple.
Okay, 30 seconds. I'll go really fast. The health insurance companies, they make money because they get a slice of the larger pie. The problem is they have no interest. There's no market mechanism having them create a smaller pie. It's always growing, and they're going to continue to try to take a larger piece of it. We need to get the government involved so that there is is competition, so people can choose if they want to go into a Medicare-based system. That will create cost controls, which will create everything else to go down. But we also can't ignore other aspects of the healthcare system that are inefficient. We need to be doing better on electronic records, and I had more to say, but we're stopping.
Thanks for choosing GLT and Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to a special broadcast of a 13th District Democratic Candidate Forum for Congress, co-sponsored with the McLean County League of Women Voters. We're coming to you from the Normal Theater in Uptown. What measures do you favor to reduce and eventually zero out the federal deficit? Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up first this time.
That's a big question. The bill that was just passed by the Republicans and signed by Trump is not the way to do it.
The tax bill?
The tax bill. And creating, $1.41 trillion debt by 2027, going the exact wrong direction. And none of that money is allocated for infrastructure right now. In order for us to move our country forward, we have to make investments in infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, but also waterways, pipelines, electrical grids. Those investments pay us back time over and over again. It helps our rural communities, it provides jobs, and it strengthens our local economies. I think a way that, in addition to cutting some of the costs that we have in some of our federal programs, we can move to, instead of focusing on pay and chase model where we have to go after people for paying bills. We can focus on making sure that we're addressing waste and error in the front side. There are programs to do that effectively. But we also have to make sure that the money that we are spending is coming back to us and is not just going to help corporations and the wealthiest 1%. It's got to come back and help the middle class and help our local economies grow.
Jonathan Ebel.
So I can tell you what I wouldn't do, which is slash Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and I can tell you that that's what's on Paul Ryan's agenda, and if it's on Paul Ryan's agenda, it's on Rodney Davis's agenda as well. This tax reform bill, as Betsy just pointed out, is a disaster, and it is going to add $1.5 trillion to that deficit. So I think that there is an opportunity here to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat for our entire nation, not just for the Democratic Party, but for our entire nation. This will be a ruinous bill if it is allowed to stand as it passed. My suggestion is that we actually enforce a 22% corporate tax rate. Now, that rate was cut, remember, from 35 or 34% down to 22%. The dirty secret is that corporations were never paying 35%. If you're AT&T, you were paying between 8 and 12%. So, hey, let's live by the letter of that law. Let's close the corporate loopholes in the tax reform bill, and let's make them pay the 22%. Let's also reinstate the estate tax, and finally close the carried interest loophole so that those who are making money on trades while they're sitting back are being taxed at the same rate that those who are working in McDonald's or building our roads are being taxed as well. I think we can generate plenty of revenue by those moves to begin to move our budget to a neutral place.
Thanks. David Gill, deficit reduction.
Well, I've been saying for a long time, Charlie, that it's time for the millionaires and billionaires in this country to pay their fair share. That would go a long way toward helping with the deficit. As the other candidates have indicated, the recent tax reform passage was a travesty when it comes to moving in that proper direction. As John indicates, the corporate America, they've actually been paying 18%, and almost half of the large corporations have been paying a grand total of zero in taxes. And the reason that they've been paying such low rates is because of the thousands of loopholes that are contained within the tax code put there by lobbyists who funnel money into your congresspeople. And so an indirect step toward helping with our deficit would be campaign finance reform. I also believe there's numerous steps to help with the deficit. We need to stop the endless warfare that we engage in, the bloated military budget that is the sum of the next 8 to 27 countries, depending on who's doing the counting and how you're counting. We need to stop the privatizing of prisons, and we need to stop locking people up for nonviolent offenses. It's one of the reasons that I support the legalization of recreational marijuana. And you grow your economy and ultimately reduce your deficit by investing in people. And that's one of the reasons I support a $15 an hour minimum wage now. Good for everybody, especially good for the servers in this country who are really damaged by having a $2.13 per hour minimum wage. And another way you invest in your people is by having the green revolution that we so desperately need to ultimately save our species.
Eric Jones.
If you go to Representative Davis's website right now and you click on his views on the deficit, he will say, you'll see that it says that it's a crisis we, quote unquote, cannot ignore any longer. I looked up ignore in the dictionary just to double check, and it turns out that adding over $1 trillion to the deficit is the opposite. We have to do something about those issues immediately. The fact that they did a corporate tax cut and a tax cut for the super wealthy, and they've got nothing for it, there's nothing that's going to end up in American jobs, I think is a travesty. And that's number one. No more tax cuts for the super rich and corporations. Two, we need to stop something called inversion, which is this notion where corporations are reconstituting themselves in other countries so they can evade American tax law. We've got to put a stop to the loopholes that all the corporations and others have referenced this and the super wealthy are using so that you and I are paying a higher tax rate than a lot of the wealthiest people in this country. And that's unacceptable. And then secondly, or finally, I would say, there is something we need to do on waste, fraud, and abuse in our government. that is something that is a problem, and it's something I've worked on before. As a congressional investigator for the House Oversight Committee, part of my job was uncovering places where the federal government was wasting money. And I'll tell you, that does happen, and we can't ignore that. And as a member of Congress, I would work on those issues to ensure that we are spending our resources as efficiently as possible. And the problem that we've faced is a lot of the Republicans are trying to cut the very institutions, whether it's inspectors general or the Department of Justice, that are actually working on these issues. And that's another way to save money.
And Angel Sides.
Yeah, I think the tax plan, the new tax plan, is going to put us, have America have even a higher deficit. We need to end the loopholes. And when we have the wealthiest 0.01% of the wealthiest families in this country own as much wealth as the bottom 90%, and they don't pay their fair share of taxes, and they usually loopholes and they get out of paying taxes, that is our taxes. I mean, they own so much of the wealth. So we need to raise the corporate tax rate and end all these perpetual wars where 64% of our discretionary spending goes. We need to stop highly subsidizing industry to the tune of billions of dollars a year. And we really need to raise the minimum wage, I think would help. It's proven to help in communities and help the economy. We're the cities that have passed a raise in the minimum wage. But I really feel like we need to rein in these corporations when five men own as much wealth as the bottom half of the planet to operate in the state they originated from. And that would open up a lot more mom and pop operations. I think that would help the economy immensely.